Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome to A Republic If You Can Keep It. I'm Mark Brewer. Happy New Year. The entire podcast this week is devoted to the politics of the week, and it's been quite a week, and we're only midweek in this extraordinary week. So let's start off with the Chatfield bombshell, I'm going to call it. Jeff, what's your take on what's going on with the former speaker?
Holy shit. That's my take. It's like, for those listening in Michigan and outside of Michigan, this has made the news just about everywhere that the former Michigan House Speaker in Lansing has been accused of sexual assault by his sister-in-law, dating back to when she was either in middle school or early high school, up until this last year, up until 2021, that started when she was a minor, continued once she was an adult, married to his younger brother, who was employed by him, and using coercive tactics, according to one article, an interview with her and the younger brother, using all kinds of psychological and financial coercion to groom her and keep her in place, and using his position as his brother's employer to keep his brother out of the way when he wanted to visit his sister-in-law. And so the salacious nature of this is clear and incredible, and if in any way true, is a horrific, not just political scandal, but an awful crime committed by somebody who was not a child, against a child, at least at the start of it. And so that is an incredible, incredible allegation. So I guess there's that aspect of this, but then there's also allegations that are made or alluded to in some of these articles that include comments by his younger brother or sister-in-law that hint at all kinds of financial improprieties, including in one article mentioning misuse of public funds. There could be misuse of campaign funds or misuse of nonprofit funds. Those are all speculated in different articles. So we're looking at a potential, at a sex scandal that includes possible criminal charges that could include statutory rape. I guess I don't know statute of limitation deadlines on any of this stuff. But then there's also a financial scandal that could be looming out here that could involve any number of people, not just the former speaker, but it could involve people who were complicit in this, people who had knowledge of misuse of funds, if these stories are true. So that's let's start with that. That's been big news over these last few days.
Right. So let's kind of tease this out and expand on your great summary there, Jeff. So on the criminal side, we could have multiple crimes over many years. From what I know, Chatfield could end up in the prison for the rest of his life if this stuff is true. I mean, these are very serious allegations that have been made. You know, people underage who can't give consent, coercion, et cetera, et cetera. But let's focus on the financial piece. Because as you and I know from our time in politics in Michigan, there are several parts there. Let's start with the funds of the state house that, again, our listeners may not know this, that literally the Speaker of the House controls the entire state house budget.
Which is millions of dollars. Right. Several millions of dollars.
Tens of millions of dollars. Right. Same thing is true on the Senate side. Right. That money, there's maybe an internal budget, but there's no accounting, there's no auditing. It's the legislature is not subject to the FOIA. So in many ways, that money is a giant slush fund, frankly, and can be used at the Senate leader's discretion or at the discretion of the speaker, subject to whatever internal controls they may set up. that's an enormous, enormous temptation, right? To be used for personal things, political things, you know, that it really, and again, never disclosed, except in a circumstance like this, where you may get a prosecutor, state or federal, you may get a grand jury, state or federal, start to inquire about what was going on with these public funds. So that's just one pot of money. Am I right on that, Jeff?
Yeah, yeah. The public funds aspect is, you know, that was alluded to by members of his family, of the speaker's family. And so that's, you know, this, it's not just, that's not us speculating that it could include public funds. That issue was raised in the complaint or in interviews with his brother and sister-in-law. And so that's clearly a matter of, I'm sure, great curiosity to a whole lot of people.
All right. And then there's a second pot of money. Chatfield was an extraordinary fundraiser, not just for his campaign committee, but I think at one point he had four PACs, did he not, Jeff?
That says four PACs giving extraordinary amounts of money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to different campaigns and candidates.
Yeah, I think those PACs cumulatively probably raised, they have been millions, certainly hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah, millions. And well, I saw like right away, just a tangent here, that in the race for the Republican nomination for attorney general, as soon as this news broke, Matt DiPerno, the Trump-endorsed candidate, jumped all over this because Chatfield's PACs have collectively given Tom Leonard, the former House Speaker who preceded Lee Chatfield, Chatfield has given Leonard more than $72,000 to his attorney general campaign committee dating back to 2017 or 2018. And so, yes, there's huge sums involved. And there's a whole lot of people that could be tainted by this money.
Right, because as I recall, Chatfield was Speaker pro tem when Tom Leonard was Speaker. So he was part of the Speaker's team, right? As all this was going on. Now, I don't know if Leonard knew anything about it or whatever, but there's a very close political relationship there. Anyway, these PACs and his campaign committee, they can, you know, not only spend money on elections, they can also spend money on incidental kinds of things. But you can cover up a lot of activity by describing something. Oh, I went to a conference someplace, legitimate expense, it looks like. But what did you spend and what were you doing in the evenings after the conference?
According to these articles, those evenings were spent in strip clubs in Detroit, for example, and using these funds. So that clearly would be of interest to those who regulate, say, campaign finance law, whether it's candidate committees, PACs. If they're using these funds for something like that, that's I don't think that's helping elect or defeat a candidate. So that would be.
And then we come to the final pot of money, which is, you know, possibly 501c4s, these social welfare organizations, tax exempt. They do have to file an annual return, but it's, you know, a year after the fact. And it's also not difficult to kind of disguise what you're spending money on. This is the kind of fund that got Kwame Kilpatrick in all kinds of legal trouble in terms of what he was doing with his C4 fund, going back to when he was in the state house and then continuing as mayor. You know, so if there is misuse there, that could have tax consequences, right? Those C4s can lose their tax exempt status. They could have tax liability. If they were providing essentially income to Chatfield or others, there may be tax complications for Chatfield and others.
A personal tax complication.
That's right.
Personal liabilities,
so,
right.
There's just a wide variety of potential problems here, depending on which pots of money, maybe all of them, were used and for what purpose. But like I said, it's grist for an aggressive prosecutor. I understand this complaint was filed with the Ingham County prosecutor, grand jury, et cetera, et cetera. This could take quite a while to investigate and try to unwind what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, and this is very, very new. I mean, this is only a few days old, and it broke just before the weekend, I think. And so it it really hasn't had much time to kind of come to light exactly where this is going, what it might involve, whether it involves local, state, federal investigations. You know, there's been rumors for the last several years at different points in time of grand juries. Well, not just rumors, but there's been grand juries and indictments into public corruption cases, most notably in the city of Detroit, that snared several city council members. But there's also been quiet whispers around Lansing about grand juries being sat and people talking to grand juries about public corruption tension in Lansing. And there's been no charges, nothing that has come of that, but there has been enough whisper and enough smoke that there could be some fire there. It just takes something like a story like this with somebody who has knowledge and motive to maybe talk about it to break a story that has wider ranging implications.
Yeah, and these C4s, I'll tell you, could be a real problem. I mean, there are lobbyists in Lansing who offer to set them up for legislators, and people are always looking for some way to, you know, get some dark money, because the way the reporting goes on those, you don't know who the contributors are. So there could be quid pro quos that people are not aware of. It's just a great temptation to abuse those, and the system makes it so easy to set them up. It's just, you know, it's very, very worrisome, the lack of transparency. Because I think if there was transparency about what those C4s are doing, what the State House budget is being used for, that would certainly be a great disincentive to all this, to the temptations to misuse that money without consequence.
Yeah. And aside from the legal consequences here, or potential consequences, looking at this, you've got a politician who was at the time and still is the youngest House Speaker. He was House Speaker before he was 30 years old and was term limited out, I think, by the time he hit 30 years old, beat a Republican incumbent in a primary back when he was first elected to the legislature, running as a Christian school teacher, running as a Bible thumping family values candidate. And, you know, politics is so full of hypocritical tales like this. This is our Michigan's version of Jerry Falwell Jr. at Liberty University here is what it looks like. If a fraction of what's been alleged is true, and what's been admitted is, by the former speaker is through his attorney admitted to consensual affair with his sister-in-law over a number of years and admitted to multiple affairs is what his attorney introduced into this story as well. So this just underscores the stereotype of candidates that act. I'll use the bad pun here. Holier than thou. End up in situations like this, and it's the ultimate glass house tale.
Well, and there's so many organizations and people that have given money to these various entities who received money from these various entities, and I think now the press and others are going to be asking, are you going to give it back? What did you know about what Chatfield was doing, et cetera, et cetera? Because again, the vast amount of money that he was able to raise and the broad scope of his basic political operation and the impact that it had. We've seen scandals like this, but legislative scandals in other states. There was one in Ohio recently over some legislation. There have been scandals like this in Wisconsin and Illinois, coming back to, again, vast quantities of money being available in the system without any accountability. And then, lobbyists and others who see an opening and can leverage that into trying to get something that they want from these officials.
Sure.
Let's see how this plays out.
Yeah, well, this has great potential. I mean, you mentioned Ohio and Wisconsin. There was also the Michigan House Fiscal Agency scandal 30 years ago, the federal House Post Office scandal where everyone was kiting checks and kind of effectively looting money through the House Post Office. And what scandals like this have the potential to do is change the narrative. And in an election year where everyone's talking about now the narrative is how many seats are Republicans going to win in this off year election when the Biden and the Democrats control the White House. This is the kind of thing that has potential in a state capital or in a state like Michigan, where there's key statewide races. Control of the legislature is going to be really up in the air as we head into the fall with redistricting and term limits. This is the kind of thing that can override any kind of national narrative if a fraction of it, this stuff is true, or what we're speculating on has potential to have a lot of collateral damage and could taint the entire, depending on where the fallout lies, it could taint all the candidates running for state house in Michigan under the Republican label. It could be something that that they can't get out from under through the election year, because as the allegations they come to light in January, and if there are criminal investigations and then indictments, is that's all as election day draws nearer. And so then there will be charges of politics if prosecutors bring any charges, that this is all politically motivated. This is going to be a big story as 2022 goes on here in Michigan, that could have national implications when it comes to control of Congress, control of certifying the elections in 2024.
Yeah, I see that Tom Leonard has already played that card. I mean, DiPerno says, give the money back. And then Tom Leonard says, how dare you politicize this tragedy by doing that? So we're going to get this back and forth. And I think that's just the beginning of it. People
say, you got legislation. Sure. I guess the one thing looming out there too is, okay, you mentioned the C4s and these slush funds and legislators leaving office controlling these funds that have hundreds of thousands or seven figures when they leave office. That's clear that has become a pattern. I have no idea. Tom Leonard was speaker before Chatfield. I have no idea if he has a C4 or not. But anybody who's been in that position is now suddenly shitting bricks and thinking, who's going to be looking at me? What did we do? That's the kind of thing an investigation can bring all kinds of suspicion on, even if there isn't anything improper. Just the fact that you are engaged in this behavior makes you guilty in the court of public opinion or in the court of voters on election day.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is going to just another bad mark against government. Right. It's just going to add to the public cynicism and distrust out there. It's a very unfortunate all around.
Sure. Well, and, we're focusing on the Republicans. I'm sure the Democrats right now are looking at themselves and saying, what have we done with these funds? Because if the lid is blown off, it might not be a one party fallout. That's, I have no idea. I assume most people aren't completely cavalier and going to strip clubs with their 501c4 accounts, but everybody's probably investigating their own accounting right now and questioning their own expenditures over time to make sure that they're on the side of angels and aren't going to have anything. If things get exposed, that they're not going to look bad.
Right. I mean, you and I and Bob LeBrant, my client, have a pending complaint. It's been publicized in front of the Secretary of State about two of Shirky's c4s.
Yeah.
And what we believe is their inappropriate use to fund ballot proposals without disclosure. So, again, that may just be the tip of the iceberg in terms of the abuse of these C4s. We'll have to see how it all plays out.
Mark and Jeff will be back after these messages on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at The Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Well, let's turn to some of the other things that have been going on this week. There have been some developments in terms of the congressional races. We learned that Brenda Lawrence is going to retire. Within 24 hours of that, I don't know if they were connected, Rashida Tlaib says, well, that's the district I'm going to run in, which contains Dearborn and a lot of the community that she believes she represents, even if they're not in her district. Mm-hmm. Which then opened up the other congressional seat in Detroit, more of an east side kind of district. And we've already got Sri Thanadar and Sherry Gagnogil announcing for that open seat. So I think we've had some interesting developments there. Any other thoughts on what's going on in the congressional races, Jeff?
No, I mean, there's at the end of the year, when we first got the final or the Independent Citizens Redistricting Committee passed their first iterations of congressional state Senate and state House plans, we talked of the game of musical chairs that goes on. And that week, there was a whole lot of movement suddenly going on and a whole lot of announcements. Some of the fallout from those maps, it takes a little longer. This is a development. It's not that surprising when you look at the fact that I don't think anybody during the course of the last couple of years speculated on Congresswoman Lawrence retiring. But she has, you know, she says personal reasons, you know, why she wants to retire. She would have been a shoe-in favorite to win re-election in that district that included Southfield. But the fact that Rashida Tlaib is now running in that makes a lot of sense. It includes a whole lot of the territory that she currently represents. The proposed lines in Detroit have changed so much that this is a tremendous amount of the territory that she currently represents, not only in Detroit, but outside and around Detroit and Wayne County. The addition of Dearborn is a natural constituency for a Democratic member of Congress who's of Arab American descent. I mean, that's that just is a natural fit. So that's not surprising. Once Lawrence retired, that was a very natural place for Tlaib to announce her re-election attempt. I would imagine in the open seat now on the east side of Detroit, including the Grosse Pointes and some of the other northern downriver communities, that those the first two candidates that we've talked about there aren't going to be the last two, that we're likely to see a very long list of candidates. Detroit primaries typically bring in a long list of potential candidates, each who will have some constituency, current legislators, term limited legislators, former legislators, county commissioners, former county commissioners, members of the city council, former members of the city council. Who knows? There's going to be, we'll get into probably some more black and white politics. We'll have potential for, is people start to look and calculate at how votes will be carved up. You know, will there be somebody emerge from the gross points as a white progressive candidate or from the downriver areas? So there's a whole lot of we're going to have to wait and see on what the roster of candidates is going to look like. But the congressional cake, if the districts stay as they've been passed by the commission, that cake is starting to look relatively baked in terms of who's going to be running where. There could still be another surprise or retirement. Fred Upton could announce after, you know, almost four decades that he's not going to run again rather than running a primary against Bill Huizenga. Now I think the attention will turn to the state legislature and who's doing what where. And, as people start to look at, will there be any litigation? There's already, prospective litigation looming on some of the on some of these plans. I don't know if anything has been filed yet. I know it has been announced, but I don't know if anything's been filed.
Just continuing on the congressional piece for a moment. It looks like the battle between Stevens and Levin is starting to lock in a little bit. Levin got a union endorsement this week. I've seen her. I know Stevens is out there campaigning, so we'll see how that plays out. There doesn't seem to be any Democrat interested in running against Slotkin. We've had a number of Democrats say, I'm not running. People seem to be rallying around her. And then just today, I think I saw, correct me if I'm wrong, that all this teasing from young Bill Schuette was not about his dad, that today he announced he's running for state house. We'll see. His father obviously could still declare and get into that congressional race against Dan Kildee. But at least that's how that has played out for the moment. And I know Democrats out in West Michigan are taking a look at the Meyer seat.
Well, and they should. Going back to the Bill Schuette, the former attorney general and losing gubernatorial candidate for the Republicans in 2018, has been speculated and his name has been floated by some of his allies as a potential candidate against Dan Kildee. I still go back to the fact that Schuette, when he ran for governor in 2018, lost that new congressional district by like 16 points. So it's not exactly his for the taking. There was a development there. Paul Young, who lost to Alyssa Slotkin in the different district, announced he's running there. He ran a really tough race, lost to Slotkin by like 3 points, was a credible candidate, raised a lot of money, has money. So right now Dan Kildee has a very credible challenger on the Republican side. And in the kind of the kabuki dance behind the scenes, that might be an indication that Bill Schuette, the senior, is not running there. Yeah, there was when Bill Schuette, the younger, started teasing an announcement, everyone thought, oh gosh, is he going to run for Congress? But no, he's running for the state house. And so, whatever. That's seems to be a likely Republican district he's running in. So whatever.
Yeah, and I think on the legislature, as you and I both indicated, there's a lot of open seats in the House because unlike the last two gerrymandered plans, incumbency was not a factor in terms of protecting people. So there's a lot of open seats, a lot of people moving around, obviously a lot of representatives on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, looking to run for Senate. So that's going to have an impact as well. And like you said, maybe even running for Congress, taking a flyer at some of these seats. It's interesting to note that unlike the old constitutional provision, there is no time limit on suing over these maps. Our old constitution said 60 days. V&P's proposal doesn't put a time limit on it. So I think we're still looking at a window for litigation beyond the initial Voting Rights Act suit that was filed last week. And we'll just have to see how that all plays out. There's still plenty of time until filing deadline. We've seen filing deadlines moved in the past, back sometimes a couple of months to accommodate the fact that courts or plans were making decisions late. So I don't think we've quite settled yet in terms of the legislative maps, that there still, I think, could be some changes there.
Sure. Well, I'm looking at the requirement when you're a legislative candidate that you must be a registered voter who meets the qualifications in the district you are running in. I would think that my old friends at the Michigan Realtors Association would love this plan, because there are going to be a whole shitload of candidates who are suddenly in need of realtors because they need to move and establish residency in a district that's adjacent to theirs and includes territory that they've represented but don't necessarily live in. So we could see a spike in home sales just because of the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission.
Right. I've got some clients that are already moving, Jeff.
I imagine there's going to be.
You have to be a resident and a registered voter in that district for 30 days, is what the statute says. And we have seen litigation and challenges over people who try to be cute about that. You know, they rent an apartment, or they're living in their brother's basement in order to establish residency, when in fact, maybe they're not. This is the time of the cycle when there's a lot of that scrambling going on. To make sure people satisfy all those legal requirements so nobody questions their eligibility to run.
Yeah, if anybody at Rocket Mortgage is listening to our podcast, maybe they should open a politician's division to help ease the mortgage application process for aspiring politicians to move quickly before the filing deadline.
Now, that's obviously not an issue for the members of Congress, right? Because of that provision in the federal constitution. You don't have to live in the district. It helps politically, but this is a concern for state legislative candidates.
Right.
It's also for incumbents. It's a little tricky because there's a provision in the state constitution that says you can't vacate your district or else you vacate your seat. We've never seen that enforced. It would take a 2/3 vote of the relevant body to enforce that. But it gets a little tricky if you're moving out of your current district in order to qualify into a new one. So I just say there's lots of business for lawyers these days as people are asking for advice on how to deal with the new districts.
You know, COVID continues to be on everybody's mind, and cases are still exploding. Positivity rates are increasing all throughout Michigan. And we've had this week a couple of notable people in the political sphere test positive. Governor Whitmer's husband, Mark Mallory, and Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist. I guess this just underscores that this isn't going away anytime soon, and it continues to impact politicians on both sides of the aisle.
I think that's right, Jeff. I mean, frankly, it was no surprise when I heard about both of those cases. There are a lot of public officials that I know, and you probably know some too, who've got COVID and aren't talking about it because this latest variant is so contagious. I've seen it. I got friends, I got relatives, I mean, who have gotten through the pandemic healthy so far, but now have been exposed or have it. So, I think those two are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of public officials who have it. I saw today that the state of the state is going remote again because that's not going to work. I think this is going to be affecting a lot of public meetings who would otherwise maybe held in person. They may go back to remote. We're starting to see courts cancel jury trials again, like we've seen in the past, just because this variant is so contagious. And it's really going to spread. We'll see how long this lasts. I think it could have an impact on petition drives, like we saw back in 2020. Yeah. I had clients who canceled petition drives because it was just impossible to circulate petitions under those conditions. And, you know, we could well be in the same position now. You know, if there's nobody out there that you can walk up to and get a signature, it's going to be really difficult to qualify something for the ballot. And it affects both sides of the aisle.
You know, it does. Yeah, you're right. Well, it's gotten some attention here in the U.S., but French President Macron has really gone on the offensive against the unvaxxed. And he's got zero left to give when it comes to whether or not he pisses off the unvaxxed, who are the ones responsible for continuing the virility of this virus and the fact that it continues to spread and mutate. And this provides an opportunity for politicians to underscore the fact that it's largely largely, not exclusively, but largely predominantly Republican anti-vaxxers who are at fault for the continued spread of this. Yet they're the ones who continue to now win to try to politically capitalize on the fact that, it's Joe Biden's fault that we continue to have this virus. Oh, Governor Whitmer's husband has COVID. So, you know, what's she doing? You know, she's failed at stopping COVID. This is the classic case of arsonists yelling about the fires. We have too many fires that we've set. And so that's something that I'm waiting for a politician on the Democratic side to stand up and punch these morons in the mouth rhetorically and point the blame where it belongs.
Well, I'll just say, switching topics, I like that theme. Many of us Democrats were very happy to see the speech and listen to the speech that President Biden gave last week. Or even though he didn't mention Trump by name, he certainly called him out. And a lot of us Democrats, and I think a lot of Republicans too, Jeff, who've been waiting for that speech, and it was very heartening to finally see it.
I loved it. I mean, it's no secret where I stand when it comes to Trump's complicity, the Republicans' complicity in the attempted coup last January 6th, and the fact that Joe Biden called President Trump out. That's exactly what we need. We're not going to get anywhere. We're never going to get past this most heinous attack, one of the most heinous attacks ever on the United States. And the more we find out about that, the more we know it wasn't anything spontaneous. It was a conspiracy to overturn the election. Biden's calling it for what it is. The Republicans are screaming they're screaming at the top of their lungs about divisiveness when we need to be brought together. Bullshit. They need to be held accountable. And a lot of those people who are complicit in it are right here in Lansing, members of our congressional delegation who called for the overturning and decertification of Michigan's votes, who called, who signed letters, who joined lawsuits, who voted against certification. They're part of the conspiracy.
I'm really eager now to see what the January 6th committee, the select committee, is going to release. There's a press story today that somebody, and I think they have names, filed forged certificates of electors on behalf of the slate of Republican electors who were elected, and they actually sent them to the National Archives. That may be a federal, if not a state, crime, you know, forging official documents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I hope that if that happened, somebody gets prosecuted. We also saw a press story recently that the January 6th committee was interested in talking to Monica Palmer, one of the infamous Wayne County Board of Canvassers members who voted or refused to certify the election initially. So it appears that despite the obstruction by the Republicans of the select committee, that it has talked to a lot of folks and has a lot of documents. And I'm looking forward to the release of those.
Me too. And that's a wrap for this week's podcast. Thank you for joining us.
If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send us an email. comments@arepublicpodcast.com. And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Stay warm.
You can subscribe to A Republic if you can keep it on your favorite podcast app. A Republic if you can keep it is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.